Fasta mai, as bvailiam ker fel cherry ujus a chlesho, as an enemy, shach le. Mish Marilyn Crellin. I'm Marilyn Crellin, and I'd like to welcome you to Shach Le. In Shach Le this week, Unsa Chle and Shachton Shaw, Ronzacher, Shanachus, and Elion, researching the island's history. Stephen Miller RBV talks about finding out more about our past and of sharing that information. As Dayton son of Gillian Ed, and dates for your diary, starting with one this evening. This evening, Thursday the 16th of April, the Meadowside Choral Society with their musical director Julian Powers will be giving a concert at 7:30 in St Catherine's Church in Port Erin. The Meadowside Choral Society is a mixed-voice community choir which was founded in 1962 and is based in Colby. Admission to their concert in St Catherine's this evening is free and there'll be a retiring collection. That's an opportunity to hear the Meadowside Choral Society under their musical director Julian Powers this evening, Thursday the 16th of April at 7:30 in St Catherine's Church, Port Erin. Sheen Sheu Lair Jeg Mi Avril and Leva Kaga Kalodnon on Shahi Jeg She has died. For ISSC and Fla Charles Edward Stewart, for the Nishli uns Eru, Nanistru Ailtioch, as for Gunan Mura, Exesha Kagi and Rishoras, Liao Var as Lyotad, Moraine Ayatasi and Fla, as Vadnus Murekis as Fondach, uns Kaga Sight, Na Othak Na Jamesi Vey. Rosha Treshen, Van Manin Egit Fona Duke and Athol, Master and Klein Murray, Vaslion, Hig Darawe Kasolach, to Jinnach Aben Flaffel Yale. As for Inadok, Egechut Riol, Hogor Dow, Manach Rawad Paul Dylan Rishores, Egechut Slew, Dindachol Noi. Niai Master and Luck Time Murray, for Altrin Var Vain and Yamasi, Unshachi Jeg as Queg Jeg, as Dariad to Fall Dylan Re Harish Achidan. Van Bunje Shaw, Darawayan a Duke in Athol, Machan and Vannon, De imacad hin de Kirelach, on shen nahaka lurgenhaga kalodden.
At the time of the early Jacobite attempt to restore King James to the British throne from 1715, the House of Keys seemed to have been not very keen to arm the island against possible Jacobite landings. The running trade had attracted a number of Scottish merchants into the island, and the trade into Scotland was brisk. With Scottish involvement, the runners also became a way for messages to be passed, and the crossover between the running trade and Jacobitism is fairly well documented, as shown in Francis Wilkins' book The Isle of Man and the Jacobite Network. By the time of the Jacobite rising under Bonnie Prince Charlie in 1745, the Lord of Man was James Murray, the second Duke of Athol. Some of the Murray family had been and remained staunch Jacobites and commanders of the army under Charles Edward Stuart, but James Murray's position secured his allegiance to the royal court of King George II. After what was, for the Jacobites, a disastrous engagement at Culloden, a warning was sent to the governor of the Isle of Man, Patrick Lindsay, that some Jacobites might try to take refuge here in the island. Lindsay had been issuing orders from the time of the threat of the prince to raise his banner in 1745 for people arriving in the island to be carefully examined to make sure that they weren't Jacobites. The Keys by this time appeared to be more in tune with these precautions. Captains of the parishes were put on the alert for anyone landing at small places rather than landing at the main towns. Small, out-of-the-way coves were, of course, part of the way of life for many people here in the island connected with the running trade, which also had that Jacobite current running through it. Out of this state of alert, two Scottish men, James Napier and William Simpson, were taken and brought before Governor Lindsay. They said they were chapmen, with assistance from a Scottish noble, Sir John Douglas. Lindsay apparently believed them, but insisted that there should be a letter from Scotland to vouch for them. They in fact got a letter from a different Scottish noble, Sir William Maxwell, but that was good enough to get them released. Later, it turned out that both of these Scottish nobles were Jacobite sympathisers. However, as Napier and Simpson went back to Scotland, it looks as though they were just chapmen after all, because if there was any suggestion of their being Jacobites, Scotland was hardly a safe place to be, with Butcher Cumberland and his men hunting Jacobites down. Caution was exercised by the Duke of Athol and Governor Lindsay to demonstrate allegiance to the Crown, particularly with Murray Kinsman being Jacobite. And so the Duke copied to the British government all of these orders that had been made by Governor Lindsay in 1745 and 1746 to show their allegiance. But overall, it's another example of how looking at the island's history can spiral out to wider connections, and so the island was affected in the aftermath of the last battle fought on British soil, the Battle of Culloden, of the 16th of April, 1746.
Rishimadi Blinton, Borlach Taitashdi Vannan, Kermak Erish Leo, the Anim Adol J. De Derek e mach e screwin j documentin nach rau ave rach evan roi. Vad sio domenic pishin gyara mechiawn cushin na cuata chumnachin na rachahortus an elia mechiawn an vei ec slai. Megeddon va artan oan mechiawn rud na sambl de hianachus va furin iach en yeddon mach tull yw fys e. Hog Irish Leon Taitashti, Caird Epishin, Beg a Device Screwit, Michaun Rain de Hushin, Van an Yarachin an Ersach, Uns Dinna J. Vey, Nan Vin an Inzak Slura, Uns Kuma J. Peber Oluach. De Miech Hall, Henk an Irish Leon Gajera, as when Kermax Jerry, Uns Nike Jeggers Carefeed. We've been fortunate this year that Stephen Miller RBV has been here in the island on a couple of occasions, giving presentations on the folk charms collected by Sophia Morrison and about the scale and breadth of activities which Sophia Morrison was involved in. This coming Saturday afternoon, the 18th of April, Stephen will be giving another presentation at 2:30 in the Athol Room of the Centenary Centre in Athol Street, Peel. The title of it is I Often Think of You and But Very Few Beside You. Edward Farragher and Carl Roder, Folklorists and Friends. Edward Farragher of Craignish, or Neddy Beg Hom Roy as he's known, is recognised as an important poet and writer in his native Manx. Carl Roder was a German businessman living and working in Manchester who collected and published information about Manx folklore. Manx folklore is an aspect of the island's culture that Stephen Miller researches and publishes on. Here he is to talk about his work.
Stephen Miller, RBV. You have articles published in learned journals. You give presentations to international forums. Where did it all start for you? What was it that captured your interest and decided to develop this?
I did history at the University of Leeds. That was my undergraduate degree. And it was very much then, and I think still these days remains, almost, should we say, classic kings and queens. You know, it is very, very much great men and occasionally, you know, great women. But it was always that sort of emphasis. There was never that emphasis, I thought, on the personal. And I met someone who was doing, at the time, Leeds University had the Institute of Dialect and Folklife Studies, and there was a Master's in Folklife Studies. And I met this Canadian who was doing it, and I thought this just sounded so off the beam, you know, to study folklore. And I found out more about the particular course, and then I took the MA in Folklife Studies, and then I realised that there's a great archive here in the Isle of Man, and ever since then I have been, should we say, exploiting it, using it, publishing it, whatever. And so that really is my particular interest. It's not really a history in that sense. It was a looking at actual people's lived experiences, people's past lives, not in aggregate as the working class, the middle class, the upper class or not. You could get down to that particular level of individuals themselves, such that you can go into the Manx Museum Library and fish out the letters of Edward Farragher, a fisherman from Craignish. You can read his letters to Carl Roeder. You can see the folklore that he's collecting. You can get that sense of a connection with the past. It can sound very woo-woo at times, but there's this very clearly that you are reading a letter written in the 1890s. You can see the script itself, you can feel the paper itself, and you can project yourself back into that community.
But in addition to researching these things, from the start you've always made a point of making these things available. What was the idea behind Cholloch Books, as it was, that you established?
I learned very early on that so much of the books that have been written about Manx folklore and so on are just simply out of print. And they are available on what was then called the antiquarian market, what we would now call the second-hand market, and at a hell of a price. And also, too, you just had to wait for them to come. This, because nowadays it's quite easy. You just go onto the internet, you go onto A-Books, type it in, and they are there. But in those particular, especially if you wanted W.W. Gill's Manx scrapbooks, you just couldn't acquire them. Mm. And I thought, well, we're going to lose sight of the past. We're going to lose access to these particular materials if they are not available. And also, I also have my particular view is that I'm very well aware, as you said, a lot of my research, because it's published in academic journals, it nowadays, in the past, it was a question that, were they on the shelves? Was there a library that took them such that people could go in and read them? No. And nowadays, now that we've moved to the internet, now more and more material is online, but it lies behind paywalls. It's institutional accounts. And if you're not at a university, or if your local library doesn't subscribe to these particular journals through schemes that they do have in the United Kingdom to give increased access to these particular resources, no one reads what I've written. And I'm just writing then for other academics, and I'm actually not writing for Manx people. Mm. So I thought, in the end, why not just start Cholloch Books, and in the end, why not start Manx Notes, and why not start just simply putting this material out? As you know, I have my own website, and I try and place as much material as I find, what I say, in the public domain. It's there for people to read, it's there for people to use. Mm.
But going back to the start of Cholloch Books, though, that 1993, it was physical books, the first things that you brought out.
It was indeed. My first job was at Oxford University Computing Services, and we had there a typesetter. We had a laser comp, a monotype laser comp, because that was a particular time when academics, particularly when they were using, should we say, specialized fonts. For instance, we had a font for doing hieroglyphics, for instance. That was the time when authors were being asked to deliver camera-ready copy. And so you could already see that print industry was starting to contract when they were switching from what originally was hot metal to photo typesetting, that these fonts were just not available. So I was running this particular service. There was two of us. One ran it for the University of Oxford, and I ran it for users throughout the United Kingdom. So as a consequence, I had to learn typesetting, because I had to learn how this particular machine worked. This is the days before even computers. This was attached to a mainframe. So this is before we had PCs, Macintoshes, before we had PageMaker, before we had InDesign, before we had Quark Express, all of these particular tools. So I had to learn how to typeset. And in the basement of the computing services, we had Tony Hunter. Tony Hunter was a time-served master printer. And he was an absolute stickler for good typography. And so you would go down to Tony, and he'd look at something, and he'd say, "Rubbish, go and do that again. Rubbish, go and do that again." And so you learn from him the difference between a hyphen, an N rule, an M rule, a figure dash, three-quarter figure dash, three-quarter M rule, and so on, and so on, and so on. So I learned how to typeset. And I had access then to a typesetting machine, and I thought, well, why not try reprinting books? And that's how Cholloch Books came about. So there were early days. It was all, it's now changed so much now, because, you know, it's Ingram Spark, print on demand, In those days, it really was running bromides, as they were called, or film, 1200, 2400 DPI, plate making, and everything had to be runs of 500 because that's a ream of paper, so printers know how to control their paper stocks. And they did well. They did absolutely extremely well. And I'm extremely grateful for it's now gone, the Book Gallery in Peel, but they certainly supported Jolic Books and they sold through him in great number.
Now, since then, you have gone online, you've got the website, which has a whole wealth of material that you've been doing. So what's your modus operandi when you approach this? Because obviously you're not based in the island, but you're researching so much concerned with the island. So how do you go about it?
Well, in the early days, it really was just pen and pencil transcripts. That was it. You sit in the library, you call the stuff up, and then occasionally you could get photocopies made. It was a question then of having photocopies made, doing pen and pencil transcripts and literally hauling the stuff, not quite literally hauling the stuff, but you know, filling your suitcase with stuff and bringing it back to where I was living. Of course, you couldn't do these days, it's all bag under the seat, Ryanair, it was probably... You'd have to just pay for it now, but I would just simply bring the stuff back. And then, of course, the game changer certainly has been the rise of what was the point-and-click camera. Nowadays, the point-and-click cameras are gone because people's phones are just as good or even better than what you get on a point-and-click camera. But there again, you always get that issue that you shoot away and shoot away and shoot away, and then you go back and you find, oh, there's a blurry image, or you start thinking, scratching your head and saying, now, what manuscript was that again? Oh, I didn't write. You know, there's always a question where you call workflow, but you can resource yourself well these days, but I think there is still then the issue of access to what is called secondary literature. I mean, for instance, JSTOR, which is a wonderful project that has digitized academic journals and back issues of academic journals. But there is still, should we say, the regional, the county journals, the typical proceedings, transactions of this particular society, the typical 19th century antiquarian. For instance, you know, the proceedings, the Alemann Naturalistischen Antiquarian Society are still locked away in that sense in print. They haven't been digitized. They are not available. So there's always that time and you always start thinking, oh God, what's that page number? Oh, what's that article? Oh, I didn't get that down. Is there something there? Is there something there? So there is still that particular frustration. You know, you're so near and yet still so far.
One of the things in researching Manx folklore, particularly looking at Edward Farrag of Craignish, a great writer in the Manx language, what are the difficulties of approaching that sort of material?
In the sense of Farragher, the material that is in Manx, George Broderick has translated.
Right.
And also, as you know, I have no Manx. I make no apology for that. I was of a generation where it was poo-pooed, and it was a generation where, no, you should be learning French. I always remember my parents saying to me, we're going to the common market now, you should learn French. So I've never picked it up. So the material that is in Manx, George Broderick has always been very, very helpful. Rob Tier has been very, very helpful. Chris Lewin has been very, very helpful. So I do have people that I can call upon if I do need anything to be translated for me. But I think we still have to face that the bulk of the material that is to do with Manx folklore, Manx folk life, is in English.
It's very much an accumulative process, isn't it, that you follow?
One just picks up on certain themes, certain ideas. You read something and you start thinking, I can get an article out of this. You start thinking this. I mean, for instance, the pieces that I've just done are the Sophia Morrison folk charms. That was done by, as you say, I was at a conference in Bucharest on, it's called Cha Cha Cha, Charms, Charming and Charmers. And someone simply said there's space in their journal in Cantatio. Do you have an article? And I did indeed have an article that was a fuller article that I had written for a Dutch Celtic Studies journal where they wanted us to, in fact, produce a shorter version of our article. So I had this full article present. That was published. I gave a talk on that. There's another talk on Manx folk charms coming up in September. So sometimes it is just by chance, a chance conversation, which is the reason why I do enjoy going to conferences, symposiums, workshops, you just get these offers. And then other times it's just an idea comes into your head. You come across some materials and thinking, yes, I can develop an article off of this. For instance, I've got two articles at the moment that I just need to do finishing touches to it. Henry Jenner visited the Isle of Man in the 1870s. Looking at the status of Manx in that particular period. He'd sent a questionnaire around the Manx clergy. Those materials lie in the British Museum. They've been lying there ever since Jenner passed. And so you start thinking, yeah, this now needs to be written up. And then you start thinking, yes, there's also the parochial visitations as well. They also have questions about Manx as well. So you then write that up again. And I was recently in Edinburgh. I had a chance then to visit the National Library of Scotland to read John Francis Campbell's diary of his visit to the Isle of Man in the 1860s. And you're thinking, well, it's just a short, you know, he was only here for a week, so it's just a short few pages in his diary. And you start thinking, well, this is something, again, that I can develop an article off, and this is of interest, so publish.
Mm. And it's finding these archives as well. So how do you find out about those kind of caches of material which suddenly emerge?
Well, we are fortunate now that due to the levels of funding in the United Kingdom, particularly with lottery funding that has come in, that most libraries have now catalogued their collections. It is absolutely quite remarkable what you can find. One thing, though, I would say, one thing is you perhaps hope or expect that there is going to be some hidden source of material. You think there is going to be, and to be honest, there is very, very little. And most of it lies in the Manx Museum Library. I think the only thing that I have been surprised about was the letters that the Reverend Savage was writing in the 1870s. You have to look that up, that I wrote that they were in the John Rylands Library in Manchester. That was just by happenstance that material is there. So you would hope to think that Gill's papers are going to turn up somewhere, but we know Gill's papers are not going to turn up. You'd like to think that Roeder's papers are sitting there miscatalogued somewhere, but that's not so. I think the only thing that has been of surprise in recent years was John Rees's diaries. But I think once again, that's a question that a little bit of digging, you would have realised they did exist and they were there sitting there in the National Library of Wales. But I think what we really are dealing with is the material that is lying there in the Manx Museum Library. And I think back to what I was talking to about and what we've often talked about is there certainly is amongst folklorists, I think, a sense that not everything was recorded. There's always that sense of particular loss, and it is certainly true. You know, there is a sense of loss that we do. You know, we have Farragher's letters, and we have the folklore that he collected for Roeder. And you're thinking, yes, but so many others could have collected it, and should have collected. You know, is there more? Is there more? You look at. I was talking to someone yesterday about Sophia Morrison's papers, and because we know they were meant to go to the Ward Library, you know, that magnificent bookcase that was there, that was built for her personal library and her manuscripts. And you're thinking, well, we know the material that now sits in the Manx Museum Library. Is that everything? You know, has material been lost along the way? Did Morrison discard material along the way? How big an archive did she have? And it was just an imponderable, you know, it's an imponderable. Because you look at Gill's material, and we know that Gill was collecting with his brother and with Clegg in the 1890s, but we know from letters that he came back to the island and was collecting again. We certainly know that he was collecting from Elizabeth Crane and her daughter, who's also equally Elizabeth Crane, at Coolbenn, because we have Sophia Morrison's letter there, where she goes round to collect from them, to realise that they'd already been visited by Gill, but not visited by Gill in the 1890s when he was collecting with his brother. Mm. So you start thinking, well, where's that material gone to? But then again, you then have to then step back and saying, well, we have the Clegg tune books, which have not yet been edited in full. So we always want more, but we don't really, in many cases, do a lot. I think we need to start focusing on the material that we do have to hand and start editing that material.
Stephen Miller, go to my board, thank you very much indeed.
Stephen Miller, RBV, talking about his research work and the development of his initiative in establishing Charlock Books. You can hear Stephen's presentation, Edward Farragher and Carl Roeder, folklorists and friends, this coming Saturday afternoon, the 18th of April at 2:30 in the Athol Room at Peel Centenary Centre in Athol Street, Peel. All are very welcome, and there'll be an opportunity for a couche over light refreshments at the end. A donation of £3 would be gratefully received to help with overheads. This Sunday, the 19th of April, there's the Seed Swap and Plant Share, a gardening event being held in Laxey Working Men's Institute between midday and 2 o'clock. Entry to the event is £1. People can bring their spare and unwanted seeds, seedlings and plants to share with others. Also gardening books, tools or other items. You just leave your offerings on the table for others to consider and look out for something that would suit you. This, the 15th Seed Swap and Plant Share, will be over both floors of the Laxey Working Men's Institute. There'll be refreshments and there'll be a garden-themed raffle. The event is organised by Lovely Greens and by Laxey Allotments and Douglas Allotments. There'll be donation totes for Laxey and Douglas Allotments, and if it turns out you're taking away a bit more than you brought, they recommend leaving a donation. That's this Sunday, the 19th of April, from 12 noon to 2 o'clock in the Laxey Working Men's Institute, the 15th Seed Swap and Plant Share. As to Shen Kerleshin, Gus Jeren, Her Maxhaw, J. Shackler. So now that's it from this edition of Shackler. So from me, Vaughan, Marilyn Crellin, Sledden You.